Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to Madison Professor Nina Bondil, who graciously braved the upper Midwest winter to come here from the sunny climes of Irvine, California. So we're very thankful for her bravery in doing so. She did manage to get in with only about a 3-hour delay in her flight, I think, so last night, so all is well. So Nina is an economic sociologist, and that means she studies, among other things, how economic phenomena have cultural and social ramifications that perhaps aren't always appreciated by economists. She got her PhD at Princeton University, and she's studied a variety of topics, wide-ranging. I mean, she's really a Renaissance woman in some sense. So one of her themes is the political economy of the transition in Eastern Europe, and that I think will be the theme of her lecture today. But I also want to note that she works on such topics as the role of emotions in economic interactions. So that's a slightly different perspective. She works on culture, the relationship between culture and economic behavior, quite a wide range of interests. She's published articles in a wide range of journals, including the very top sociology journals. She published a sole authored book called From Communists to Foreign Capitalists, The Social Foundations of Foreign Direct Investment in Post-Socialist Europe. And she's also edited or co-edited three additional books. And she's also co-authored a sort of broad account, a general account of economic sociology. On top of this remarkable research productivity, she's very active in doing service to the profession. She's an editor of one of the top journals in our field, the Socioeconomic Review, or a co-editor, I guess. And she's also the chair of a number of different sections in the American Sociological Association, the International Sociological Association. So I guess you get the picture. She's really you should know that she's an associate professor. I don't know when she ever sleeps, but we're very pleased to have her today. Today she's talking about democracy, inequality, and foreign investment in Eastern Europe. Does the EU matter? So please join me in welcoming Professor Bondil.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ted, for this generous introduction and for an invitation to experience something exotic, see some snow, come out to Madison. I almost froze up when I came out past midnight yesterday at the airport, but you're right, it was only a 4-hour delay, and I am here, so we should focus on the bright side. I'm excited to be able to share so I thought champagne bottles were opening already, to be talking to you about my research on Eastern Europe. I got an invitation, and we were in discussion of me coming to visit already in the summer, I think. And so this was before Ukraine, November. And I decided to speak about some ongoing work, not knowing at all that some of the things that I've been researching may have some connection to very, very recent and transformative events that are happening. I'm glad that the announcement for the Monday's event was already made, because I wanted to say that if you really have questions about that, Monday is your time. Today, we're going to take it in a broad perspective, not necessarily what's happening there, but what perhaps the EU's role has been in Eastern Europe, how to assess that influence in economic, political, and social spheres. As economic sociologist interested in macro transformations, I think about the economic, political, and social phenomena as very much intertwined, and this is going to be the broad arching theme of the talk today, and perhaps different from how a political scientist talking about EU might present, or an economist interested in some economic consequences of integration. And as a sociologist interested about inequality and social ramifications for broad transformations, I should tell you that this is, to some extent, a very personal story. I was a socialist child. Grew up in the former Yugoslavia, the northernmost republic, Slovenia. So happened that just as I was finishing high school, the country was transforming fundamentally, gaining independence, and I was gaining independence and a scholarship to go and study abroad. This is how I got to the U.S., through a very, personal story, I suppose, of a Polish professor who came back to Eastern Europe in the early 1990s, wanting to offer some opportunities to young Eastern European women to come and study in the U.S. But, of course, I could not escape my childhood, my family, who remained in Slovenia, and every summer going back, observing how some of these most fundamental transformations of our times have unfolded. Today, I'm going to focus a little bit more on the EU because I'm given an opportunity, and because I know most of you have much more expertise on that topic than I do and would like to engage you in a conversation on that and learn from you, push some of these projects further or to rethink them or to perhaps be encouraged to send them out for publication. Obviously, we have to put it in the broad context of the events that are ongoing. When I saw this picture from Kiev on the main square, it was interesting how it was taken precisely with the view of East and West in mind. You have the West right there with protest and demands for change, and you have the East uniform, literally and figuratively. And it reminded me of this picture, looking to the West, dismantling of the Berlin Wall, November 9th, 1989, that really changed unexpectedly to some extent what happened in the Perp region where I grew up, with what happened to my family, people I knew and followed over years in their personal experiences of post-socialist transformation. This is excitement, right? This is excitement looking with anticipation, possibly trepidation as to what is going to happen. And we've seen it all. We've seen excitement, we've seen disappointment. It's hard to give a uniform characterization of what has happened in the past 25 years or so in the Eastern Europe. And what I try to do is try to see how some of the stories that I personally experienced, people around me, people I talk to when I go back to Eastern Europe, and I do travel a lot. I have a frequent flyer status now with Lufthansa. So how does that fit into broader patterns? So some of the things that I will show empirically really are macro analyses of trends, statistical analysis of some of these trends, where my attempt is to bridge the micro perspective of the living experience with the transformations at the more aggregate level. In a way, I just want to, this may seem strange, but think a little bit about socialism and capitalism and contrast them as ideal type systems. Going back to the idea that political, economic, and social transformations are intertwined. So if we think about capitalism and socialism as institutional orders, then we can identify some of their characteristics along the political, economic, and sort of social or ideological or cultural terms. And I think it's good to have that backdrop in our minds as we proceed to more specific questions about the EU, about inequality, as I said, about democratization, and about foreign investment that I studied most deeply, I should say. My first book was on foreign direct investment in Central and Eastern Europe, and I'll tell you how I got to the issue of the EU through that project. So basically, this is this is what I've been wondering about, right? Why do people do the things they do, but how do we get from here to there? And how do, what forces, social forces, are involved in this process? Now, this is the first question, and the second question is, what are the consequences of getting from here to there? And I'm going to speak a little bit about some very recent analysis on inequality that are still ongoing, so very much look forward to your input. So some of this research has been published and it's available, so you can look at it in more detail, and if you're curious, I can point you to the references, and others is still very much ongoing. And it's an interesting choice of putting these together, but hopefully to share with you my broad concerns about these processes, and also, as I said, learn from you. I just, you know, put them in these broad pictures, I suppose, saying goodbye to communism, right? Welcoming globalization, which is where foreign investment comes in, and returning to Europe. So this is our scene on which we'll see what actors take what parts in a, you know, theater, I suppose, metaphor. And this is where we get to what I suppose most of you have wondered, which is the subtitle of my talk, How Does EU Matter? So the central question that I would like to address is, how has the European Union and the Europeanization process affected political, economic, and social transformations in Eastern Europe? And using some empirical evidence on three cases, in the case of foreign direct investment, which speaks to this intersection of post-socialist transformation, market creation, and global economy. Then democratization and income inequality is a case of social transformations. Most of you will know this chart by heart. That's why I apologize. It's not so legible. It's from my book. And you see I added Croatia here because the book got out before these events happened. Lots of dates, lots of things that have shaped the interaction between the European Union and Central and Eastern Europe. So let's go from this side. We have the first institution that was signed between Eastern Europe and the EU, which were the Europe Agreements. Basically a trade economic agreement between post-socialist states. And the first of the countries signing this were Hungary and Poland, already in December 1991. Then we see that there's a time where this agreement went into force. We see that the application for the EU membership happened. We see that negotiations began and negotiations concluded and accession to the EU. So very much a process of different kinds of things going on. And some of these things, I think, if we differentiate them analytically, are going to be able to tell us somewhat about some theoretical questions that people studying the role of the EU have had on their mind. And those have primarily been related to three themes, I'd say. The first one is, what's the main argument? How does the EU matter? Let's see if I got it right here. What does the EU do to Eastern Europe? What happened, why things happen the way they happen in Eastern Europe? Well, it's conditionality. EU has this treat to offer, the sweet entry into the European Union, and so it sort of uses the carrot and stick to get countries to comply and sanctions non-compliance. And this is how the transformation of institutions in Eastern Europe unfolds. Because it, after all, these are major changes that East European countries have to undergo. Alignment with acquis communautaire, the, you know, provisions institutionally of the European Union, with what Eastern Europe started with, you know, after 1989, and you see that these processes began very early on. There's just two worlds, if you think about them. So how can we even conceptually understand this process of change? Well, the major argument is about rational actors responding to incentives, and that's the argument of conditionality. There's also the argument of socialization. Well, so it's learning new values, norms, political culture, and mainly this is an argument about democracy and how democracy has happened, not only conditionality, some people say, but also the fact that you have proximity to these countries that serve as a model of how, you know, democratic systems work, and so now people learn. And a broader concept of Europeanization, which is not necessarily related to Eastern Europe's experience and the role of the EU, but the fact that we have had a European Union, and what does that entail? By giving an umbrella to diverse societies and facilitating some processes that many people refer to as Europeanization. So let me go into a little bit more detail, giving you some studies to link these arguments to. EU conditions see Central Eastern Europe into compliance. So this is maybe a little bit more to get people awake. Carrot and stick game, you know, the choice of words here. The conditions of membership are laid out. So it seems that the transformation, the accession to the EU was almost, as I think Mitchell Ornstein said, a telos of transformation. So the end goal of what these countries desired and where they wanted to be. That's one take. The other one, that it was not an issue politically. There were so many things that were highly controversial politically, thinking about the withdrawal of the state from, you know, social security, social provisions, about foreign investment, accepting it or not as a strategy of development, about, you know, just political transformations and the departure from the communist elites or not. A lot of controversy, but it seems very little controversy, at least in retrospect, as to whether these countries, and I'm talking about Eastern Europe here, not all of the post-socialist Central Eastern Europe and Eurasia, that they wanted to be part of the EU. Return to Europe was a slogan, I think, of the Havel's movement in the Czech Republic. Europe Now, Europa Zdaj, was a slogan in Slovenia during the independence movement of Slovenia. So coupled with sort of the national assertion was already the vision of being part of Europe, back to Europe, return to Europe. A lot of these gained very much, were very prominent and, as I said, not politically controversial necessarily. Socialization into norms. I suppose for the sociologist in the room, this is a difference between under-socialized and over-socialized perspectives on the EU. The under-socialized, the idea of we have rational actors responding to incentives, and the over-socialist, socialized to the extent that, well, there's this culture, right? This culture that people have to imbibe, that less, at least sort of diminishes the role of active decision makers, of agency, again, if we use some sociological jargon here. So you won't be surprised that I propose a third thing here, right, that maybe bridges the under-socialized and the over-socialized perspectives on how the EU influences societies. And I will go with this umbrella of Europeanization, mainly because I like one of the statements that describes this process. It basically says everything, right? So it is a process by which European Union impacts domestic discourse, so true, culture, ideas, cognitive frames, identities, in a sense, as we think of ourselves and also lived experience, but political structures, very obviously, so aligning a little bit with the conditionality arguments and policies. And there's been a lot of talk, as I mentioned before, on Europeanization, going back to the experiences of other European states that were became part of the European Union. So this literature is not necessarily contained or focused mainly on the Eastern Europe. But I think we can learn from it. I think it's useful as a concept to think about what I call Europeanization as experience. So I'd like to propose that this is sort of the conceptual thread that goes through the analysis that you will see later on, which is, well, how does EU work, right? Is it just rational incentive provision and actors responding to that? Is it there's some culture and people follow that culture? Or perhaps both of these, but something else as well. So this is the lived experience. Not only does EU influence structural and cultural context in which to which East European countries are exposed by providing incentives via conditionality mechanisms or infusing East European actors with EU norms in the process of socialization, but that it influences the ideational and interactional context of the experience of both decision makers and also citizens. So I'm talking here about, and I think maybe this is something that might be relevant for the experience in the Ukraine to some extent, about things like travel, news, meeting people, having diplomats go one place to the next, having, obviously, media discuss these topics, so not only contained to the decision-making elites, but filtering down to people and how they see Europe, how they envision themselves wanting to be a part of it or not. And I think that if we try to think about this in a broader context, it's particularly useful when we discuss Eastern Europe. Because in Eastern Europe, what we initially have, and most of the talk I'm giving today is about sort of these initial transformations before countries get into the EU. We just simply don't have yet, you know, years of data to be able to tell us so much about the consequences. We have, you know, we know about Hungary right now, we know about other cases, so that's, you know, lots of material to discuss in the Q&A, so I'll try to get through my stuff quickly so we can have an opportunity. But first 10 years, it's just a fundamental context of uncertainty. Like, everything is up for grabs. Economically, we don't know who owners are. We don't know how much things are worth, and we want to privatize. We have competition now for sort of the elite positions, and it's not clear whether it's left or right or what kind of party or how they transformed from communist ones and now suddenly not communist at all, or to what extent sort of the privilege from the former system filters into the new one. And, you know, Ted has written a lot on that as well. It's just a very uncertain context. I mean, anything could happen the next day. And so think about it, how this idea of rational actors or simply sort of imbibing norms may not be necessarily the right one for this kind of socio-historic moment. And to think that actors are practical, they're not necessarily rational. They may have some goals, but sometimes they don't know what their goals are. And so if you don't know what your goals are, how are you going to find the optimum ways to reach those? And so to think that even in these very formalized processes of European Union accession and Europeanization, we are dealing with an uncertain and turbulent environment where people have to just figure it all out. And I think for those of you who've had any experience talking to policymakers or spending some time in the region, you can, I think, relate to what I'm saying, even the role of serendipity in some cases. This is, in a sense, putting forward the idea very strongly, not denying that there's no strategy, that there's not incentives that are at work, but I think broadening that notion to take into account the precise context in which these processes have been going on. And I started thinking about that really when I worked on my first book, which was my dissertation at Princeton. Again, happened with through conversations with my father. So I was in college in the U.S., and he was transforming, for lack of a better term, a company he was working in Slovenia. And they received a foreign investment offer from Americans. It just seemed that would be the best thing for that company. I say this because one of a really neat ways of capturing the processes of transformation economically was by Salinian co-authors calling it building capitalism without capitalists. So how do you do that? Well, you bring in foreign capitalists. They will bring financial capital. They will bring the know-how. Just seemed such an obvious way of transforming Central and Eastern Europe, to letting foreign capital in and to use it as a catalyst in the transformation. There was a lot of talk about foreign investment. And then my father, going through this experience of Americans offering to buy the company, major rejection from middle management, politics, from actually the community. It was a bit of a civil action. The press was there, stories about Americans, hostile takeovers, and this is very bad, and everyone will lose their jobs, and we can do better. We just gained our sovereignty. Why should we let ourselves be slaves again? Slovenians have never been independent, but now they can't be independent. You see, emotions as well. After half a year or so, Americans withdrew. They didn't want to pursue that any longer. The companies was very quietly acquired by Germans. There was no discussion. Everyone was happy. So I started wondering, right, how could this be? Or perhaps is it a more broader trend? And started writing on this, just a little paper that then turned into a bigger dissertation. It turned into a focus more about over time, like what happens over time. We literally see no investment before 1989, and then we see proliferation differentially into different post-socialist countries. As soon as you have variation, sociologists are dancing, because you can try to explain it, right? Why is it not just one way? If it's naturally how things emerge, I don't like that word, emergent markets, because it implies it's very spontaneous and sort of by default, naturally. How come that it happens differently across different different contexts? So this was one of the major questions of the dissertation. And this is what I'm talking about, right? This influx of foreign investment and thinking about it in the context of the global developments. So the dotted line is Central Eastern Europe, and this is in terms of the world. And you see that something was beginning to happen on the global scene in terms of foreign investment in the late 1980s. And there's a lot of literature in sociology trying to figure out where sort of neoliberalism comes from and where it originates. A very wonderful work that I would certainly recommend. Where I come in is that I talk about the intersection with Eastern Europe and how potentially these processes were reinforced by the kind of transformation that was ongoing in Eastern Europe. So you see something to explain, even if you look at some of these trends across countries. Basically, what you should see at the end is that the penetration of foreign investment into Eastern Europe has been quite substantial. The world is about 25% of GDP. In 2006, it's about twice as much in Eastern Europe. So this idea of building capitalism without capitalists, well, yeah. Foreign capitalists played a fundamental role. However, there is great variation across different countries. We see numbers like, 80, high 70s there in Estonia, a very tiny country, very, very similar to Slovenia, actually, both small states or part of federations before, seem to be doing very well in the transition process, but picked very different strategies of how to deal with foreign investment. See here, Slovenia, 20%, and then Estonia at about 80. It's like, how, why? Was of great interest, and part of that story had to do with the EU. So you were so patient. Here it is. First, I'm going to tell you what economists would tell us about the role of EU in foreign direct investment inflow into Central and Eastern Europe. And I think it's a very straightforward argument. These are two sources, there are others. It matters, very importantly, it's consequential. And what it does is that it reassures investors. Entering into the EU implies credibility, implies stability, implies higher profits because of those processes potentially. And so it has a direct effect, right, on investors. What I found out when I was doing research, and precisely because I was putting it in a very broad socioeconomic context, so I was curious about the role of former institutions, or role of social networks, the role of culture, in addition to Eastern Europe, this was the economic sort of argument before I jumped to mine. Direct positive effect reduces the level of perceived risk in Central and Eastern Europe and makes the region more attractive for profit-maximizing investors, especially when the EU negotiations begin. The whole idea of this will be one Europe, let's jump on the FDI bandwagon and quickly acquire property in Eastern Europe because that will be to our advantage in the long term. As I said, very straightforward to some extent. My analysis, however, pointed more to the indirect effect of the EU, and in a sense rescued a little bit of the decision-making power and agency on behalf of elites and political decision-makers in Eastern Europe. So it's not just that, okay, this is what happens to Eastern Europe, but that they play a role. Of course, the EU is a big presence. Nobody's going to deny it. But I would suggest it works by influencing what states end up doing about FDI. We saw Slovenia and Estonia, both EU candidate countries, doing things very, very differently. And so we have to differentiate, I think, between formal and informal mechanisms here. So when, sort of in the economic argument, those are tightly coupled. We know from much of research on Eastern Europe that formal institutions are not necessarily aligned with how things are done on the ground. And that's one of the major things that I think is worth of studying still in investigating perhaps the long-term effect of the EU and some of the things that are surprising now after these countries are in the EU and we still keep seeing, I'm thinking about Hungary right now. So formal and informal measures. And shaping what I call the demand for foreign investment. So again, not just assuming that investors are the only ones who are going to play a role in the economic transformation process, that if they like something, they'll go, otherwise not. It's a relational process. Maybe they like it, but look at that, my father's company's story. They don't like you, so what happens then? So it's a negotiated process, and therefore deeply social, especially in conditions of uncertainty. However, states can legitimize this practice as desirable. And many states, not just in Eastern Europe, I have now a project that looks at the world more broadly, have done so. Using FDI for development, like really pitching it as a strategy to develop. And how? Well, professionalizing FDI, creating professional FDI agencies that would look for locations that would sort of have funding from the government, highlighting certain very prominent events, for instance, privatization of telecom, selling it to foreign investor. How is this being discussed? Is this being put on a pedestal as a way that signals that we are progressing in reforms and we are, doing what the EU wants us to do? Or not, right? And then finally, just very, very basic commitment of the governing elite to reform. Not all, people in power in post-socialist states, especially in the early period, were really committed to reform. Many had legs still very much feet in the socialist world, and enjoyed perhaps the privilege of being in, you know, sitting on two chairs at the same time. So through all these efforts, well, this is what states do, and these kinds of efforts are being influenced by the EU. That's the argument, right? And goes back to some of these ideas in economic sociology. So I'm not going to do much economic sociology here, but it is based on this understanding of relationality of the process, on the role of states in creating markets, and social embeddedness. This means cultural, political, and structural shaping of economic processes. So that differentiation between formal and informal as regards FDI, I have to move a little bit quickly here so we get to other two points. Talk about formal measures. Well, alignment with the acquis certainly is one way of, you know, showing that you've liberalized your markets, and that could have a role in FDI. But also informally, you have to show commitment, I'm saying. And if that's not there, through informal measures and through creating of legitimacy for an investment as a strategy of development, then you will see much less foreign investment. But and you know, just as a background, through some field work talking to FDI agency officials, to decision makers, looking at documents, I came up with this measure of legitimization, looking at three different kinds of things that I've just discussed. So role of foreign direct investment agencies, creation of visible outcomes, and primarily if the banking sector let in foreign investors and if the telecom sectors let in foreign investors, because these were major assets at stake, and then political commitment pretty much by orientation of the governing power toward market reform. When you pull it all together, it's sort of a measure of legitimization. And these are the ways I've just discussed. This is measured more concretely. Okay. Oh, so I want to tell you, give you a couple of stories just to put some meat to these concepts. Okay, let's start with one first. I thought they would appear one after another, but this is the case from Slovenia. The biggest bank, Nova Ljubljanska Banka in Ljubljana, where clearly it was also due to the EU pressures that part of this bank was sold to a Belgian investor. However, this was relatively late in the process, the latest of all these countries. So it's really a matter of timing here, not so much whether they did it or not, but timing and extent. Because after all, they had to align and close all the chapters. It's not that they could escape that. But you know, whether they eagerly did it or stalled that somewhat and just showed enough so that they could still go to the next chapter, that's a matter of degree as opposed to just doing it or not. And then a case in Romania later on. So Romania and Bulgaria did not get in 2004. They were just not aligned enough. And a lot of foreign investment happens precisely in that period in Poland, Bulgaria and Romania. One of these cases, for instance, very clearly, there was Petrom, the national oil company, then finally sold to OMV or OMV, Austrian company. And you know, clearly the talk here is about the EU and the fact you need to show to the EU that you're willing to do this in order to proceed. Here we go, the analyses. Don't worry about it. Look at this. So the idea here is that we differentiated between direct and indirect effects. And model two over there, you have some sort of a significant, you know, correlation, some sort. You have a significant correlation between the timing of the EU application and the FDI inflows. So more FDI inflows after they've started with the EU negotiations, which goes back to this idea that, oh, if a country started, then foreign investors are of course going to want to come because they want to, you know, take advantage of these processes. However, this, once you add a different variable, right, at the top, which is this promotion of FDI by host states, so state action, you see that that takes precedence over the direct effect of the EU application. And this is the difference I'm talking about, right? If you don't take these things into consideration, then you would just see the model, and that's why, you know, economic studies, I think, focus on that. But going one step further, we'll show you that this is a slightly more complicated process. You had a question.
Can you just clarify how you measure FDI promotion by host states?
Yes. So going back to the legitimacy factor, which has three things. One is when they establish an FDI agency. The second one is when they first privatize in banking or telecom. And the third one is what kind of government is in power. Is it pro-reform? So it's an index. I think it's a scale from 1 to 5, adding all of those things together. And so the higher legitimacy means that you've done all of these things relatively early. And it's over time, see? So you could have something in place and then add something else, and then your score goes up for that factor. Okay. So I think... Yes, but another test then would be a direct test as to what the role of the EU was on the promotion activities. And this is the test of that, right? We're trying to predict who privatizes early, who's more committed to FDI, and we see that the timing of the EU application here does have a role in that. Yes?
About the measure. So timing of EU application, that would be just years since...
That's right. Zero before and then one when they apply. Okay. Right, okay. Yeah. And I think this was tried in different ways too, with the EU agreement, different kinds of things. But you can read more on this in Europe-Asia Studies, I think, article that I have on this. So... this would be the key message on the analysis about the role of EU on FDI, and that it is, of course, influential, but it's not necessarily directly, more indirectly. Again, going conceptually back to the idea of Europeanization being more than just conditionality, but sort of envisioning and of different goals of action, policies that are desirable, and through that certainly the EU has played a role in facilitating foreign investment into Central and Eastern Europe in some states much earlier than others, and that's the timing variance that we're trying to explain. I'm supposed to finish at 1:45?
You're fine.
Okay.
Keep going.
So this is the interesting part. How about democracy, right? It's really funny how I had these analyses looking at the European Union agreement, which was the major crux point for Ukraine, right, in November. Signed the European Union agreement, not even knowing that these may be important. Looking at how the very initial act of institutional arrangement, so not the EU application, not the negotiation, but an arrangement that was primarily meant to be economic, could have spillover effects into the political sphere. How it could influence the democratic consolidation in the countries that now are in the EU. So we're looking at 10 countries that are now in the EU, Croatia included. I suppose here's the list. And we're looking at just the time period before they finished the negotiations. So really an early impact. This has been studied. And I primarily went back to it because I have two students who are political scientists. One is Romanian. The other one was in Peace Corps in Georgia. So, you know, this is how projects come about. They want to know. I said, okay, let's see. Let's look at this. Let's do some of these analyses and try to maybe tease out, is it conditionality only, or could it be something else? Could it be that some of the major effect on democracy democratization in these states started quite early on through these institutional arrangements that allowed for the process of Europeanization, as opposed to just conditionality, which is, okay, application is submitted, and application is being negotiated. Because with the application submitted, you know, they've allowed you to submit it, this is what they want you to do, to accede. Before, people would argue, they'll say, oh, always we had in mind that we wanted to be in the EU. But you know, conditionality mechanisms are not in place. Sanctions do not happen, for instance. So I want to tease out the timing. Is it the European Union agreements signed very, very early on, or is it the timing of the EU application? And so these European Union agreements are interesting because they are the first institutional arrangement. They're in the economic sphere, but I'd like to argue that they have impact in the political sphere as well. It's funny how they later on get associated with provisions for human rights, with political change and democratization, but they are not enforced. So for instance, Slovakia signs this agreement in 93. There's some major breaches going on. Nobody sort of faults Slovakia for it or kicks it out of this arrangement. So it's interesting how, you know, well, it's interesting. To me, it's puzzling then that it could only be conditionality. If you don't enforce the mechanism of the carrot and stick, then it could be something else. So what are these analyses going to tell us? Oh, by the way, this is also where I think it's important, maybe not for today, but in this project as a whole. We talk about the EU, but not so much in comparison to other explanations. We just put it in the model. We see if it's significant, if you'd like, but not what weight it has. Like, was it the most fundamental process in influencing democratization? Was it just peripheral and something else was more important? So we want to tease out the weight of the EU in comparison to other processes that could matter for democratization. And these are Freedom House scores in terms of democracy. And note, it's really the very initial period, before the only up until the negotiations that were concluded. And we are going to also compare the EU a measure of different sorts, so application timing, EU agreement timing, with the economic development, pro-reform government, electoral thresholds, or sort of the type of electoral institutions put in place, and ethnic minorities. So that's something that I haven't seen elsewhere, but that in my work on FDI as well and the role of nationalism in economy, I found to be quite prominent, and that is, you know, different kind of treatments of the other in the state. So arguing that the states where they had more of the other, ethno-national other, the processes of democratization went slower. Human rights, and just political rights oftentimes were not respected, not even given citizenship, for instance, to Russian minority in Latvia, was it, in the early, in Estonia? There were two.
Yeah, Latvia.
Okay, thank you. It's like cheat sheet notes. And we do see that many of these processes matter, right? So the question of what the weight is important. And I'm going to get to this in a second. But I also just wanted to show you the analysis. So again, you see this and just by the way, methodologically, we can talk about it. But what I learned, I suppose, in grad school was is to conduct lots of sensitivity analysis, so not to rely on one single specification. We have different ways of doing this in political science and economics and sociology. People have some strong preferences, some fierce opinions. I'm a little stoic about this, you know, fixed effects, random effects, PCSE. So tried different kinds of methods here, mainly to see if the results are robust and which results are robust across different kinds of specifications. Here, I think it's interesting. Just look at the blue here again. How if you compare the effect of the early agreement to the actual time where we could say conditionality is put in place, the EU-European Union agreements have a stronger effect and a significant effect on democratization in these countries. When we pull it all together, it matters too. So when sort of we create a scale, let's say that level one is when you sign the European Union European Agreement. Level two is when it comes into force. Three is when you submit application. Four is when you conclude negotiations. So if you do a scale, you see that matters too. But based on these results before, it seems a lot of weight in that is carried by the initial arrangement, the European Union agreements. I don't know, the story seems so much more credible now with the Ukraine, right? So you tell me, we can have a discussion. So that it truly is an impetus to some changes.
Can you remember, what's electoral threshold?
Okay, so this is from political science. This is my political science co-author here with the expertise. We had such fragmentation politically on the spheres that many people argued democracy simply could not happen until you institutionalize it so you have parties. And you institutionalize it by creating an electoral threshold for parties that can get into government or not beyond a certain level. And the idea was that if you had a higher threshold, then you've consolidated party identity a little bit easier, and that was conducive to electoral democracy. And we could talk a lot about that, right? What kind of democracy? Is it just the rules? Is it freedom to vote? Or is it really liberal democracy?
I mean, so it's basically the measure of having a stable party system, essentially.
Yeah, that's probably a good way of thinking about it. Now, what about the weight, right? What about the weight of these processes? And these are residual analysis flipped. So actually, it doesn't make sense, because if it more usually, the bigger residual, the less, you know, well the model fits. But here, it's flipped, and I should call it something else. But how much weight, right? What's the explanatory power of any single factor in this analysis? And the greater it is here, the more explanatory power it has. And you see that the EU agreement surprisingly comes up quite high, sort of on the same level as these political structures and sort of reform government. We shouldn't take, you know, one lower, too lower, but just at the broad level, certainly not that this was an economic development story. And there's so much to that says against this. These were economically developed countries but did not have democracy. So, you know, the ideas that were brought from political science literature on other states were different. And I think importantly, sort of this ethnic minority story, not necessarily the key, but certainly influential. Now, I'll just leave you with the what about, you know, what about democracy after the EU? Just talking to some colleagues about the case of Hungary, lots of protest, even in, you know, my home country, Slovenia, dissatisfaction, perhaps a reversal, and that's sort of up for grabs. Let's see how to explain it. And I think somehow goes against this idea of political culture, of just sort of learning the new things and now imbibing them. But if you go back to experience lived, you know, sort of the EU and handling of the crisis, the responses, the demands, the austerity packages, and people's reactions to that. So it's not a univalent process at all. I asked, will I have to talk for 1 hour? Now I'm talking for 1 hour, so it, I suppose, was not that should have thought about this a little bit. Now I think, this is daring, because the analysis are certainly not finished, but just such a consistency, and I'll just leave it with you out there, and that is on the income inequality. And these are the analyses that compare non-EU and EU states, and do look at sort of the progression with the EU, with the EU scale that I've just mentioned. So not just are you here in you know, the EU or not in the EU. What does have to do with to income inequality? What are your ventures? What are ventured guesses? How does EU influence? Does it influence sort of the level of inequality in these countries? That is everything else being equal, right? So not just thinking about, okay, Russia is out there, and then Slovenia is low in Slovakia and Czech Republic, so obviously there's less inequality in the EU.
Well, I'm guessing that some people profit much more from the liberalization of the markets, and so I would assume there would be greater inequality.
Wow, I don't know. It's not that I asked her to make this comment, but it goes so nicely with the story. We've never met before even. Just reading my mind, right? So we're looking at, again, a broad sample over time with many countries, most of all of these, and trying to figure some of these things out, right? Some of these trends, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Czech Republic, Romania, Estonia, lots of different things going on. And you know, these are such different countries that at the end, it really seems to me that the fixed effects model, so the model that sort of takes into account any possible characteristic that's time invariant, you know, from distance to Berlin or wherever the center of Europe is, to their religion, to where they started, right? What was it that happened to them during socialism? You know, the fact that there were varieties of socialist experience, etc. So a model that pretty much takes into account all of that and still sees if there's an influence of the EU. So I'm just going to present the fixed effects model here. And this is what we find. This is, by the way, whoever's recording that, not published, so don't quote me on this, but follow up if you're curious, that consistently we find a positive effect on the size of the Gini, which means a negative effect on equality, right? Increasing inequality, higher Gini coefficients for those countries that went through the EU process. And now thinking about the mechanisms, going back to the idea of economic transformations, really, and liberalization and privatization, even though some of the models we have, unemployment, for instance, and it's not significant and the EU doesn't go away. So I think it's more a proxy to some extent for the transformation, the economic transformation that created much more differentiation than, for instance, in some other countries, once everything else being equal. But, you know, don't, again, hold me to it. I'd like to hear your thoughts. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the mechanisms underlying this process, because whatever you do with the numbers, this is where the weight lies. It's, can you explain it, or is it just little stars on the figure? And how does it conceptually fit with, you know, what I've just told you my idea is about the EU? And so let me finish, and then we'll have a conversation with the picture that I started with, and perhaps you'll let me know how it goes on Monday and how some of the questions I have will be answered then. But certainly, I think in that context, and what I've tried to say is to view post-socialist transformations as combining integrally structural, cultural, and political and economic processes, and that if we want to understand political change, we do need to take economy and society into account as well, and the opposite holds. So you have to be a bit of a Renaissance person to do this, I suppose. And to the extent that the EU's role is not univalent, while it may have had influence in certain ways, it's not necessarily that it's uniform across the board for different kinds of outcomes, that these are based on political choices that also the EU and the EU elites make, and precisely the kinds of choices they've been making about the economy recently have had an influence in different ways. And so it's not sort of stable and a black box, but a lived experience. And there's a lot of discussion these days about where the EU is going. Is there future to this arrangement? And I think we don't have the final word on it. Lots more research to be done, and I invite you to participate in it, or at least to share some of your thoughts on what I've shared with you right now. So thank you so much for your attention.